From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Today we thought we would bring you a best of 2020 for this New Year's Eve. Our first guest is Dr. Andrew Maynard. He's professor at Arizona State University and an expert on the socially responsible development of technology. Now, he writes that human beings have a responsibility to change the future for the better. We'll discuss his new book, Future Rising, A Journey from the Past to the Edge of Tomorrow.
Our next guest this morning is cybersecurity expert and retired Army Colonel Terry McGraw. Now, McGraw is a retired Lieutenant Colonel who spent 27 years in the United States Army, where he served as both an enlisted soldier and a commissioned officer, leading critical cyber operations for various Army commands. He joins us this morning to discuss National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. We look forward to our conversation with Terry McGraw. I'd also like to thank all of our listeners that have supported us this year. And going back 8 and 9 years, we really thank you for your support. And of course, our wonderful underwriters who have supported us as well. We look forward to 2021, where we will continue to bring you the best science and technology stories.
Happy New Year, everyone. We hope you enjoy this pre-recorded show. Andrew Maynard writes, "The future holds a unique fascination for most of us, simultaneously unknowable, yet strangely malleable," he says. "It saturates our lives as completely as the air we breathe. Yet how many of us can truly say that we understand what the future is and how we're connected to it?" In Andrew's new book, Future Rising, he takes us on a remarkable journey from the Big Bang to our collective responsibility to future generations. He weaves together ideas and insights from science, philosophy, art, and more. Future Rising traces a pathway along the emergence of intelligent life through what makes us uniquely capable of imagining and creating different futures, to the profound challenges and opportunities that come with this. Andrew Maynard, welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What a cool book you have written. It's really interesting. And I just mostly have to say I love the way that you have organized it into these really accessible little bites of information. What was the genesis of your organization?
You mean apart from me having no attention span, so I really like short chapters, which was actually part of it. So yeah, the genesis of the book was a friend suggested that I write something about being inspired by the future as an object, as a way of understanding our relationship with the future. And he showed me another book, which was actually split out into 150 really short chapters. And I loved the format. And I loved it because simultaneously you can sort of read something short and inspiring, but you don't feel as if you have to put aside hours and hours to dive into it. So I reflected that in this book. And I actually found I really enjoy writing these short essays. And there are 60 of them in all, not 150, but there are actually 60 because I want to also capture this idea of time and motion from past to future. And of course, 60 is 60 seconds in a minute or 60 minutes in an hour.
There you go. Okay. So your tagline is "A Journey from the Past to the Edge of Tomorrow," which I love. And, you know, we've been told since we were in elementary school that in order to understand the future, we must understand the past, thus talking us into history and being interested in learning history because it tells us about the future. So I assume you agree with that wholeheartedly.
I do, though very sadly, humanity has got a long history of also forgetting what happened in the past. And of course, there are lots of quips about us being destined to repeat the mistakes of the past that we see in history. But the reality is that unless we understand where we've come from and what's worked and what hasn't worked, it's really hard to intentionally build a better future. And that's not just about human history, although that's important, but it's also about natural history. history as well, which is why I start all the way at the back of where everything began with the Big Bang, which is where we saw the formation of the laws of the universe that actually determine what these connections are between past and future.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Andrew Maynard. He has written Future Rising, A Journey from the Past to the Edge of Tomorrow. What was the significance of the number 60 for chapters?
So that gets into this idea that I really wanted to capture this sense of time and progression. So as humans, we are uniquely trapped in this flow of time from past to future. It's one of those things that determines every single aspect of our lives. We can't escape it, and yet we can learn how to navigate it. And so this idea of choosing 60 chapters was in part this idea of marking the passage of time between past and the future.
Oh, okay. There are so many good people out there, roughly 8 billion people on the planet today, and there's a lot of good people. There's also some Lex Luthers who are just downright evil. There's also Midas in the counting room that is so selfish, trying to monetize everything and make money. And we have this chasm between the haves and the have-nots. And my concern for the future is that even if we did remember the past perfectly, we still have all of these colorful people out there, including the Lex Luthers and the selfish. And I just want to make sure that we don't leave anybody else behind. And right now, that chasm between the haves and the have-nots is, well, it's widening, it seems, every year.
I couldn't agree more. And I think it's a combination of some genuinely despicable behavior, but it's also part and parcel of us struggling to work out how to be good people in a really complex world. One of the things that constantly amazes me is that when you really get to know people that are making decisions that on the face of it look bad, most people are just trying to do their best in under complex and difficult circumstances to build a better future, except that they find it very, very hard to understand how their actions potentially impact others. So to me, one of the important things here, and of course there are going to be people that are always malicious, but for a lot of people, one of the important things is to help us all understand our connections with other people, not only other people in the present, but how our actions affect people in the future. Because when we do that, we can understand better how to build the future we would like to see for ourselves and those around us while simultaneously making it better for others as well. And of course, as you really appropriately say, it's people at the margins that so often get left behind. And it's incredibly important to me that as we embark on this future building endeavor, we work out how to ensure that they have the opportunity to inhabit the future that they aspire to as well.
So it's can we use these pieces of technology, these pieces of science, can we use them responsibly? Can we think about what the possibilities could be on the good side and on the bad side? Is that what you're saying?
That's absolutely part of it. And so if you think about the technologies that we're developing at the moment, pretty much all of them have got the potential for incredible good, but also the potential for incredibly bad things happening. So then the question comes, how do we navigate that? How do we even work out what good means and bad means? And the technologies don't tell us that. The technologies are just like a hammer. They give us a tool that we can either build things with or smash things with. But to understand what the right way forward ourselves. We've got to understand our humanity and our aspirations and our obligations. And that means we've got to bring in things like art and creativity and faith and belief into the mix.
Andrew, you know, a handful of years ago, I don't know when the term disruptive technology came into being, but, you know, let's go back about a decade. You know, when you think about the Airbnbs and the Ubers, the disruptive technology that in the beginning, it was such a positive sort of way that technology was going to improve upon some archaic structures. And now we're seeing the effects of things like Airbnbs in communities sort of upending the ability for people to find a rental for example, because it's more attractive to go put your you know, property on Airbnb. And so as you're looking into the future and you're looking at, this term disruptive technology, how do you see the people that are coming up with these seemingly wonderful ideas need to transform the way that they look at disruption?
To me, it's very, very clear, and this comes through my work and that of others. They've got to be talking to and working with the communities that they touch. So we see this time and time again that people, innovators especially, come up with what they think are great ideas, but they don't have the breadth of understanding to understand what the downsides are. And as a result, they end up making a real mess for those around them. But ultimately, they pull the rug from under their own feet as well, because they lose that ability to continue with their enterprise. And so it's very, very clear from the work we do around areas such as responsible and ethical innovation that if we're going to nudge these innovations towards them actually truly benefiting society, the innovators have got to drop some of their hubris and their belief that they've got the right answers. And they've got to start talking to the communities that they're connecting with, listening to them, and paying attention to what they say, and actually having the humility to co-create technologies that are going to be good for others as well as good for themselves. So this is not easy, but if we're truly going to build a better future, it's something that's absolutely got to happen. Otherwise, we're going to see wave after wave of technologies that look good on paper, but actually are really bad when you see the social implications.
Is there a category of disruptive technologies that you see that has accomplished that today?
No. So there are areas where we've been better at it and areas that where we've been worse at it. And again, looking back in history, you can see over the past 100 years, we've had a number of really disruptive technologies, everything from the internal combustion engine to air flight to the semiconductor industry and computers. And by and large, we've done okay. We've made some really big missteps, but we've had the time and the luxury to course correct with those and to try and get things right. The challenge these days is that the innovation cycle is so fast with these disruptive innovations that we've gone from decades to years, and even sometimes sort of get less than a year, which means we have no time to understand what's going wrong and to course correct. And that means that we've actually got to start thinking from the get-go as these ideas hit the initial drawing board, around thinking about how we engage people to understand how to do this better. Now, we've tried to do that a little bit with technologies such as gene editing and nanotechnology, which is about using atoms and molecules in interesting ways to create new materials. But we've only scratched the surface of what we need to be able to do here. And I would actually add another thing there. So if you look at the area of artificial intelligence, which is really grabbing people's attention at the moment, there is a lot of talk about how we develop AI ethically. So that, on the face of it, looks like we're having these conversations earlier about how to get things right. The trouble is, those conversations around ethics really don't get to the heart of practically how you do this. And as a result, companies are still creating artificial intelligence technologies and solutions that I think are going to come back and bite us.
And of course, with AI, there's questions that we don't know yet to ask, and we just need to kind of make our way there, I guess. You know, Andrew, I'm thinking about what you said at the top of the show about your short attention span and the 60 short chapters. I have a short attention span, too, and I've really enjoyed these small little chapters to be able to get through them, and there's little nuggets of gold in every one of them. I wanted to start with hubris, which is chapter 40. And I really appreciated what you said about cancer. So in 1971, Nixon came out with this U.S. war on cancer, followed by 2003, the U.S. National Cancer Institute director then, Andrew von Eschenbach, said that, we're going to have an ambitious plan to eliminate cancer by 2015. And then, of course, President Obama launched the National Moonshot Initiative to eliminate cancer as we know it. It was less time constrained. But what you said in the chapter, I really appreciate, maybe we can talk about this a little bit, is you say, and I'm going to quote you, "If the war on cancer has taught us anything, it's that our biology is far more complex than we originally thought. And easy fixes to complex problems are often elusive." Can you talk about that?
Yeah. The war on cancer is a great example of this, but we see it in other places as well. We have this amazing ability to tell ourselves stories that we can fix the biggest problems just with more science and more technology. We can science the solutions to big problems. And the reality is we can't. And that's not to disregard science. It is incredibly important in terms of making progress towards some of these complex challenges. But if we don't have the humility to understand that we're dealing with incredibly complex problems, not only that, we're dealing with problems where if we're not careful, the solutions become the next generation of problems. We're not going to be able to ensure that the future is brighter than the present to a lot of people. So with cancer, what we've actually found is that we've been so fixated on this being a problem which is tractable by simple solutions that we've actually taken our eye off the ball in some cases with the sorts of things that we can do to ensure quality of life for people that are actually struggling with cancer. And sometimes we need to take a step back and have the humility to realize that the problems in front of us are bigger than our abilities to find simple solutions to. And as soon as we do that, it opens pathways forward to step by step actually building a better future, recognizing that we're never going to get to that absolutely pure, perfect endpoint.
Yeah. Mm. Andrew, there's a lot of research that went into this book. What most surprised you as you studied and put this book together?
So interestingly enough, I think what surprised me was the optimism that I had when I was writing it. Working in the area of technology innovation and society and the future, it is really easy to get pessimistic about what's happening. I mean, you look at the world at the moment and you look at the dysfunction, not only with how we're struggling to deal with things like coronavirus, but you look at the social issues we're dealing with and the meanness that we're seeing through society. So I was expecting this to be a really depressing, pessimistic book. But what surprised me is when you dig underneath the surface and see what we're capable of as humans, our ability to imagine the future being different, the ability for us to develop the means to get there and build it, the ability for us to actually put ourselves in the shoes of others and not only understand what the future looks like from the shoes of others, but to have the motivation to help them build it for their sake, not for us. This is incredibly hopeful. The challenge, though, is we've got to be intentional about it. This hope only begins to be realized if we actually grasp it and we commit ourselves to building a better future for others. So, yeah, that strangely enough, it wasn't any of the sort of technology or the science or the understanding, but it was the realization that I'm more hopeful than I expected to be.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. If you're just joining us, our guest is Andrew Maynard, PhD. He's the director of the Risk Innovation Lab at the School for the Future of Innovation at Arizona State University. Wow, what a name of a department that you're the director of. Can you talk a little bit about what you do there?
Sure. So, yeah, there are two parts. I'm part of the School for the Future of Innovation in Society, which is a really unique school set up at Arizona State University, where we bring together people with very different areas of expertise and very different training to see how we can better understand our relationship with the future and how we ensure that we can build a better future for everybody, not just a few. And then in my own work within this, I'm really interested in how we create value in the future. So I work on risk, but to me, risk is something that threatens to rob us of the things that are important to us. And of course, some of those things are our health or the environment around us. But sometimes those things are important. In fact, usually those things are important. So things like our beliefs, our identity, our sense of self. So a lot of my work revolves around how we can understand how to protect and grow the things that are important to us as individuals, but also as a society.
That's nice. Going back to what you talk about, you know, this optimism that you found that you had, that you surprised yourself with, part two of the book is called Uniquely Human. And you do go down, all of your chapters are things like feelings and faith, imagination, curiosity, then loss and despair and possibility. But in these uniquely human chapters, you don't mention, you know, lack of humility and hubris, which seem to be very big players in how we're looking at the future.
Yes, and those I think sort of thread through the narrative as you go through those chapters. But of course, there's no way you can capture what makes us uniquely human in just a few words and a few chapters. So I was trying to find sort of key points that began to sort of fit together to build a bigger picture. And of course, sort of some of that is the nature of what it means to be human, but some of it is how we even think about technologies and how they define what it means to be human as well. But I hope in there is this bigger picture that emerges that also captures ideas of humility and hubris and just the nature of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk to you about the challenges of time frames as technologies come out and get your thoughts on that. Adoption of new technologies, people in the horse and buggy business, if they were building buggies and carriages or they had stables or they were in the feed business, they had 10 to 15 years to be able to adopt and get retrained and as the automobile came on. And then as technology continues to come out, the time frames get shorter and shorter, so that if you had a video store, you were the CEO of Blockbuster, you had about 2 years to get out of that business
right.
When Netflix came along. And the technologies today are coming fast and furious. What are your thoughts on that?
So I actually think there's a bit of an illusion here, but only a bit of one. So without doubt, not only the speed of innovation, but the speed with which those innovations are transforming society is accelerating. And it's in part because of the way that we're so interconnected globally, that now ideas run around the world at the speed of light, and people pick them up, and they change the society that they're in, the communities that they're in. So this is a reality. But where it gets confusing is we've now got this whole raft of digital technologies or digitally enhanced technologies that move incredibly fast. We're looking at sort of innovation rates at the order of months or years. At the same time, if you're looking at physical innovation, so you're looking at sort of, say, developing a new computer chip or, say, quantum computing, for instance, you're still looking at an innovation timeline of 15 to 20 years, and that really hasn't changed over the last 100 years or so. So sometimes I think that we get the impression that the speed of innovation is faster than it is in some cases. But without a doubt, because ideas move very fast through society, we're seeing disruptive changes come about far faster than they were 50 or 100 years ago. And because of that, as a society, we've got to work out how to be far more agile in how we plan for these and adapt to them.
Well, that's interesting. Andrew, you are a very curious person. What one question, and you can go anywhere you want with this, what one question would you like to have answered that has not been answered yet about our future or about a certain technology, about anything? Yeah,
wow.
One question.
One question. Oh, that's not really fair because there are so many interesting questions to ask.
Give us two or three then, maybe.
Right. And I sort of immediately sort of my mind went to areas such as sort of understanding the brain and how we can use that understanding and to live different lives and to sort of transform our lives. My ideas are formulating here. Here's the thing that I would like to ask, which is one question. And it taps into something that I've written about called base code. And it's the idea that we're actually beginning to learn how to code reality. And so the idea is that we can now code DNA, so we can change the nature of the biological world. We can play around with atoms and molecules, so we can actually code physical materials. We can change the nature of physical materials by using atoms as code. Of course, we can do that in digital space. So my question, my curiosity here is what happens when we develop a generation that understands how to code code in all of those three areas simultaneously, that they break down the boundaries between what we can do in cyberspace, what we can do with materials, and what we can do with biology. What will the world look like when they learn how to do that?
Mm. Boy, that is, it's interesting. You know what I'd like to know, Andrew? I'd like to know the nature of consciousness. Did it rise from matter? Is it ubiquitous across the universe? That's the thing that keeps me up at night.
Right. Such an interesting question. And of course, one that I guess humanity has been struggling with for centuries, actually millennia now. And we think that we're getting closer to it as we begin to understand the brain. But actually, the more we understand, the more mysterious it seems.
Yeah. Well, I've got just about a minute left here, and I wanted to ask you, you know, going back to this notion of having these short chapters that are so easily accessible, that really captivating, let's go back to the Big Bang. How do you explain the Big Bang in your very short chapters?
Actually, I would have to remind myself of how I sort of get into that. But I should say that I put this here because to me, as a physicist, this is so important, because before the Big Bang, our notion of the future didn't exist, which means we couldn't even think about a past and a future. So it's really important to realize that there was this starting point where everything we know sort of came into being. And I'm sort of busking here because I'm trying to remind myself of how I actually sort of captured this in a short chapter, other than to say that this thing happened. It was the origin of everything we know, everything that defines us.
Well, we'll let you off the hook on that if you want.
Thank you. So I thought it was such a great thing having short chapters, but of course my memory is also short as well.
I love it. I like to know that a physicist like you, very accomplished, and also has a short attention span. It kind of makes the rest of us feel better. Andrew Maynard is the author of Future Rising. It's a great book. And thank you so much for joining us. It's been a really interesting conversation.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Andrew.
Our next taped interview is with Terry McGraw.
Our guest is cybersecurity expert and retired Army Colonel Terry McGraw. We'll be speaking with Terry about National Cybersecurity Awareness Month and steps Utah parents can take to secure their children's data while they learn online. We'll also speak with him about steps Utah's local and state officials should take to protect their communities from cyber attacks. Terry McGraw, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning, John and Lynn. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, we really enjoy having you on the program. COVID-19 has challenged all of us, particularly small businesses and their frontline workers. And now a study conducted by the National Cybersecurity Alliance states that 60% of small businesses who are hacked will go out of business within 6 months. Between COVID-19 and cyber hackings, it's kind of a tough time to be a small business, isn't it?
It is. Unfortunately, e-crime is on the rise because it's continually successful. And small businesses, I don't think fully appreciate the business risk that is introduced by the interconnectivity these days. And there are simple and effective things you can do to lower your threat profile and to be more successful in preventing those kind of attacks.
Yeah, it's kind of a 1-2 punch because the employees are returning to offices, or maybe they're still working from home. They may be using unauthorized software devices, and they're certainly stressed out. At the same time, the IT infrastructure people, they're struggling to keep up with demand, while attackers are seeking to exploit all these vulnerabilities. So it's sort of a more difficult time for IT infrastructure. There are things that they can do, but they're all stressed, aren't they?
Yeah, I think both the user and the administrator alike, and business owners we're all stressed. I mean, this has been a stressful time for all of us. I would say that unfortunately, The COVID and quarantine just accelerated a move that had already been happening. You know, with the Internet of Things and the interconnectivity that we all have now, I mean, your refrigerator can be connected to the Internet and provide a vulnerability. I mean, at the end of the day, this interconnectivity and ubiquitous nature of Internet access, for all its benefits, also offers lots of threats. And businesses were going to have to deal with that one way or the other. You know, we have people working from Starbucks, and you have a remote workforce that we were already seeing start to build over time, and COVID just forced that to be far more prevalent. So I think that the security measures and architectural measures that businesses would have had to have undertaken over time, they've now been forced into that situation, and unfortunately, a lot of that has been unplanned and not well thought through on the execution.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with retired Army Colonel Terry McGraw. He's a cybersecurity expert and led critical cyber operations for various Army commands during his tenure. Terry, I'm wondering, well, since you mentioned working remotely and at going to places like Starbucks, although most of us aren't working at Starbucks now, yeah, because they don't let you sit down unless you go outside. But for a decade, for the last decade and a half, we've always been warned not to do certain things when we are logging on to a public system, a public Wi-Fi. What are the threats that have evolved over that time? Because I feel like a lot of people just, they sort of click that away and disregard it and say, you know, nothing's happened yet, so I think we're good. You know, IT departments across the world have become more secure. What are the real threats there?
Yeah, so I think that some of the devices have become more secure by default, but the reality is, if you're out and about and you're using a public wireless access point, you have no idea where your data is going before it gets to the website that you intended it to go. You have no idea who's sniffing that traffic or eavesdropping on that traffic. And if your traffic is not encrypted, it is, you know, obtainable. And so if you're, you know, surfing to your bank account, or you're, you know, having sensitive data, or you're conducting business at the, you know, remotely, and you are using a public wireless access point in, you know, a restaurant or the airport, you know, or abroad, you have no idea what happens as your data is traversing that infrastructure. So having a virtual private network, you know, an encrypted tunnel, if you will, that starts at your device and secures that transmission until it gets to its intended, you know, web server recipient, is a very, very good thing to continue to do. And virtual private networks are very, very inexpensive. There's many good ones commercially available, and they're very, very easy to set up. And I highly recommend people have them for when they're out and about in public. But there's other things that you can do even at home that will greatly improve your security level that aren't very difficult to achieve. We just have to spend some time talking about, you know, what to go do. I'm happy to talk about that if you like.
Well, let me first ask you a question about virtual private networks, VPN. If you are employed by a workplace that uses one of these, and yet you are at home working, you know, out of your bedroom office, and logging onto the VPN takes a couple more steps, and sometimes it takes a lot more time than we're willing to. And when we get up to go get a cup of tea, it sort of logs us off. So people tend not to do it, I think, speaking from my own experience, we'll say. Tell us how important it is to always log on to that.
Yeah, again, it really is establishing a secured tunnel between you and the business entity that you're trying to log in, whatever work infrastructure you're trying to tag into. It's not foolproof. It's securing the information tunnel between you and your work. It provides a secure encrypted layer so that information can't be eavesdropped on. But when I say it's not foolproof, for example, if your home computer that you're using for work access happens to be compromised and you have, let's say, a keystroke logger on it, and you log into your VPN with your username and password, well, that keystroke logger is going to capture that username and password. So having an insecure device and still logging into VPN still poses a problem for you and the business. So there's other steps that you need to take to ensure that your device is locked down, your security software is up to date, your operating system is patched, and you're using multi-factor authentication in addition to the VPN to secure. And yes, I know it's additional steps and it can be rather inconvenient, but the price is awfully, awfully high. We're not kidding. 60% of business is going out of business if they've been hit by commoditized e-crime. That's a staggering number. And then, of course, you add the pressures of COVID and quarantine. And it's really, really something that we have to almost, if you're a business, you have to insist on. Inconvenient or not, it's everyone's livelihood at stake.
So for the parents of the kids that are online, a VPN would be a good thing to do. Also, patching their phones, patching systems. What other things can they do to ensure their children's data is intact?
Yeah, so first, I make sure that you have a good antivirus solution on whatever device you're using. Let's dispel a couple myths here. Just because you have a Macintosh does not mean you're safe just because you bought a Macintosh. For the first time ever last year, Macintosh had more critical vulnerabilities than did Windows publicly disclosed. So at the end of the day, ensure that you have good security software on whatever device you're using. Ensure that the operating system itself has all of its patching and updating, and the applications that you run on your laptop are updated. And when I say multi-factor authentication, that's a critical piece here because it's establishing that you are who you say you are, where you say you are conducting your business. That's not just your username and password, but it's some other additional form of information that you have to provide, whether that's a secret question, a one-time password sent to your phone, an authentication app on your phone. Some other additional piece of verification is required to ensure that you are who you say you are, you're where you say you are at, and that you're accessing the system appropriately with a secured laptop or home desktop. Those are really, really pragmatic and very simple things to do, but have a big, big impact on your safety at home.
Terry, let me ask you about another myth, and I've heard this over the years. I just don't know if it's true or not, and that's that the security software companies have the best hackers working for them, and that, I mean, there was reports years ago when McAfee first started that employees were, once a product was released or once an update was released, employees were able to hack in. I don't know if they're leaving back doors or if this is just some sort of technology myth. What do you know about that?
Well, these are complex programs with millions of lines of code, and there's millions of users. Not all hackers are necessarily criminals. A lot do it for security efficacy. I mean, looking at the security, when you roll out your code or your software to the public domain, it's going to be used by people of varying skills with varying, motives behind what they do. Do software companies employ, bug trackers, bug hunters themselves? Yes, they do. Do their own development teams look at the code trying to find potential exploits? Of course they do. The stakes are very, very high, but it's not going to be foolproof. Anytime you have millions of lines of code being compiled in many different modules, the potential for vulnerability exists. And so I think it is important that, as a consumer of those applications, you continually update yourself with the latest patches that are released from those software vendors.
So, Terry, a question about software vendors. We are often bombarded with pop-ups that are saying your computer has 13 viral threats, malicious threats going on. Sign up now for this important antiviral software. And it always seems to me like a scam, and I don't trust it, so I click out of it. Tell us, what do we do in that situation?
Yeah, so if you're getting a pop-up from while you're on a web browser, it's almost assuredly a fake antivirus or a pop-up advertisement for less than, you know, legitimate software companies, and some are actually malicious. If you a proper security update notification will come from the operating system itself or the software itself. So, for example, if I'm running an Adobe Acrobat as an example, the Adobe software will alert me that there's a patch. My antivirus solution will alert me if there's a security issue, but it's already on my device. If you're in a web browser and you're getting those alerts, they're indications of two things. Number one, they're almost assuredly not legitimate. And number two, your web browser has probably not got the highest security configurations it should have either.
Because it let them in.
you shouldn't be having pop-up ad where onto your web browsers. And so you can go in there and, you know, adjust your settings appropriately. But almost never click on anything that pops up in an advertisement on the web browser. Just a good rule of thumb. Very little good will ever happen of that. And the same is true for email. When you get an email saying you need to log in to update this, or you need, your bank needs to contact you, or the IRS has, you know, wants to talk to you, please click here. Again, almost every time that's illegitimate and malicious activity, coming in surreptitiously. I always recommend that if you get a note or an email from your banking institution or some other organization that you are familiar with, go to their website directly. Don't use the hyperlinks in the email. Spear phishing and phishing email look very, very sophisticated these days. Mm-hmm. You cannot always tell. So it's just a good rule of thumb. If you get one of those notifications, just open up your web browser and log in yourself. And, oh, by the way, law enforcement agencies, the IRS, the FBI are not going to send you an email saying that your Social Security number's expired, right? I mean, those things don't happen. And any time that you feel, you know, that you just see that may not be legitimate, it probably is, and you should pick up the phone and verify.
I think all of us have been tempted at one time or another to reply to an email or to answer one of these phone calls that they're calling you to tell you that your Social Security number has been compromised, and just take a few minutes and kind of mess with them a bit and tell us why. I've never done it, but I've wanted to, you know, and tell us why we shouldn't do that.
That's actually a great thing, and I have messed with them myself a little bit, but I'm,
because you know the right things to do.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is you're being contacted by a criminal organization. Those are employees of a criminal organization. Don't kid yourself. These are not individual actors. These are crime organizations. And anytime you're impeding with a criminal organization, you never know when they're going to react badly. And if someone decides that, you know, they didn't like the way you behaved and they have a criminal organization on their side, well, you know, now they're up in the game a little bit against you. It's better just to hang up. I know it's tempting. I hate these unethical. I just can't stand them. They manipulate and take advantage of the most vulnerable in our society.
Yeah.
You know, some of the least educated and some of our elderly folk. And I just despise it. But almost nothing good will ever come of it. And you run the risk of becoming a target that gets engaged more deliberately instead of at random. So I would not recommend you do that. If you can always report it to your local law enforcement. You can report it to the cyber crimes unit of the FBI. Just, you know, so they can gather the data on where, when, and what. They won't be able to do anything about it, but it'll go into the repository. But engaging with criminals is probably just not something I recommend the average citizen do. I'll give you an example. A billionaire casino owner, who I will not name, decided to say some really, really negative things about the Iranian government in public. And the Iranian Republican Guard cyber unit went after his casinos and burned their network to the ground. And it cost millions of dollars to reconstitute his organization. And so, again, if you want to poke the bear, be my guest, but you have to understand that there could be consequences to doing that. It's better to let law enforcement agencies and governmental agencies deal with that than you to try to do it on your own as an individual. Just words to the wise.
Terry, we've done cybersecurity shows in the past, and we keep hearing that you can go onto the dark web. I've never done it, but you can go onto the dark web, and for about $50, you can get all sorts of spyware. Generally speaking, are the good guys or the bad guys winning?
Well, it's clear the bad guys are winning based on the amount of money that's lost every year. And I like to tell people it's not about individual bad actors. This is a global underground economy. As you mentioned, every tool that you need to conduct a criminal attack using cyber is freely available in the dark web. You can lease infrastructure, you can lease malicious tools and software, ransomware as a service. All you need now to become a cyber criminal is a desire to commit crime. You can lease everything you need to do that. But it is an economy. There's manufacturers, there's retailers, wholesalers, venture capitalists, there's resellers. At the end of the day, it is a global economy, and its job is to monetize criminal activity. And as businesses and people, we need to understand that these aren't just kids in hoodies in their mom's basement. Again, this is a criminal organization. The stakes are very high. The amount of money that's being generated here is staggering. And so as a consequence, it's a real economy, and we have to look at it that way. You can't just look at it as individual bad actors, because that's not at all true anymore. And unfortunately, because it is profitable and it is easy to do, the least ethical among us tend to endeavor upon becoming those cyber criminals, and that's a sad testimony, but it's true.
Terry, you are the president of PCmatic Federal. Can you tell us about your company?
Sure. PCmatic actually started in the consumer antivirus space. Unlike most antivirus solutions out there, PCmatic sort of looked at the problem set as the inverse. Most of your antivirus software says, well, I'm going to look at everything running on your computer, and I'm going to detect what's bad, and I'm going to block it. And on the surface, that sounds good, but what happens if you don't detect bad quickly enough? We took the inverse approach, which is, if it's not a known and invalidated known good, it's not allowed to run. So they call that application whitelisting or deny all permit by exception. And so anyway, the consumer space is where it started, and I'm sure you've seen the commercials. But that methodology has actually been adopted in by the National Institute of Standards of Technology, NIST, and it's being pushed very heavily into the governmental space as an added layer of security, meaning applying a deny all permit by exception methodology to your applications running in your environment. And so we just took our home product, we matured it to scale to the level of governmental agencies, both state, local, and federal, and we brought our software to that market. So essentially, we're providing an endpoint security suite that bolts over top of your other security controls.
Terry, you were enlisted in the U.S. Army for 27 years, and for a good portion of that, you worked on national cybersecurity. What are the similarities and differences between working on a national and even a global scale with cybersecurity and bringing it home to that family, that mom or dad who's helping their child do online school?
Yeah, that's a great question. There is enough similarities to make it frightening. What I say by that is, a global business who works in biopharm or academia that works in energy or genetic research could be just as easily a target as a nation state. In fact, there's lots of reasons why nation states would target those kind of companies and those kind of academic institutions. So, logically, the threat set that you would normally see at a nation state level can extend well down into business. And sometimes small businesses who do business with governmental agencies are also target vectors, because you're doing business with the federal government, or you're doing business with the Defense Department, or you're doing business with your local municipality. You could be a vector into those organizations. Your connectivity and how you connect into those governmental systems could be an avenue of approach. So we do see some correlations there and some similarities there. I would say, however, the vast majority of us at home and small business and mid-sized business, the threat is commoditized e-crime. It's targets of opportunity, and it's us not being diligent that allows us to become victims. It's an old bad joke. You don't need to outrun the bear, just the guy next to you. Unfortunately, that's also true here. If you are employing multi-factor authentication, you're making sure that your software is up to date, you've got a good antivirus solution, you use a VPN when you're out and about, that significantly raises your protection level and reduces your overall threat. And oh, by the way, those are the same things I recommend to big business, and those are the same things I recommend to governmental organizations. Those are set, tried and true fundamentals, and unfortunately a lot of people just don't use them. Last little tidbit I think we ought to talk about with home users and small businesses. When you buy network appliances, like let's just say your wireless router, you go down to Best Buy or you order one from Amazon and you get it, it comes with default configurations. Please take the time to go ahead and reset the administrative passwords, lock that system down. All of the default settings are freely available on the internet. They're done that, able to be remoted and helped set up by the manufacturers. They were never intended for you to keep them that way. So not only set your user password to access your wireless, but the administrative portal that they give you where it says, would you like to change your network administrator username and password? Please do so. That's a wide vector that allows access to your device remotely that most people aren't even aware that they've let happen in their environment. So just take that additional step. There's always a wizard. It's not hard. It's very simple to do. And almost any level of change there is better than the default settings. Even if you're using a very rudimentary username and password, it's still better than nothing, still better than the administration. But always try to up your security level anytime you can with those practical steps.
And that is such an easy tip. And yet, when I search networks, when I'm rebooting my system, and then all these different networks come up in my neighborhood, for an example, they're all the default Linksys. And so there's a lot of people out there that don't do that.
It's sad. I was sitting in the cafeteria before COVID. I was sitting in a mall waiting on my wife to finish doing what she was doing, and I was having a sandwich at the local, so they have the restaurant hub there in the local mall, and I'm looking at the wireless networks that are being broadcast around me, and I noticed that one of them started to change, like the SSID, and it was being renamed very vulgar, very teenage-like things, right? Outlandish names for the security network, which told me that some smart aleck had, got into the username and password as defaults into whatever the restaurant court was using as their wireless solution, and were just randomly changing the SSID network to really vulgar names. It was humorous in its stupidity, but it also says, how very, very little thought is put into a lot of those public wireless systems and how easy it is to spoof them. So that's why we really, really recommend if you're sitting out and about, always have a VPN solution at a minimum. And if you don't need to log into the wireless, like if you got your cellular network and you've got data plan, use that. You just never know where your data is going when you're out in public. And if you're going to use those public wireless spaces, make sure you got that VPN running.
Oh, these are great suggestions, and we couldn't hear them really enough times over and over and over as reminders. So wonderful to have you. I have one quick question before we let you go, and that is... we've all been doing these remote meetings. Many of us had never been on a Zoom call prior to 6 months ago. And I'm wondering, in the beginning, it seemed in the first couple of months of Zoom calls, and I'm focusing on Zoom because it's probably the most prevalent meeting, virtual conferencing system. Yeah, there was there were a lot of hacks. Lots of stuff was going on Zoom. But now, what is the safest virtual conferencing system out there?
Yeah, so there's a couple ways to answer that. I'm a big fan of Microsoft Teams. Teams scales very well. It has a lot of enterprise features that I like very much. It handles a lot of traffic and a lot of users very well. And unlike what Zoom said, they do encrypt their traffic end-to-end. So I am a big fan of Microsoft Teams, but that's not always a great solution. By the way, Zoom is a good product. I'm not about to badmouth Zoom. Zoom is a very good product. Where Zoom got into trouble is in two areas. Number one, they told people that they had end-to-end encryption when, in fact, they did not. That was an additional feature you had to enable. So by default, it wasn't. And number two, they didn't make the user guide for setup to have the most secure settings by default. A user had to just exercise due diligence and know the product well enough to enable security features. Zoom in itself is not inherently vulnerable per se, despite the end-to-end encryption problem, but it's a good solution. Where people really got into trouble, all the Zoom bombing, was that they did a few things. They published their room hyperlinked in email. They published it on social media sites so that they could get if I want to set up a parent-teacher conference, for example, and I publicize that on my Facebook page, well, anybody can use that hyperlink to log into that user parent-teacher conference.
Right.
So the appropriate way to set that up is with a lobby or a waiting room. And I recommend this to every teacher I talk to. All of these teleconference solutions provide a waiting room. And it's a great solution for teachers. It allows you to take attendance. You see who your students are. You recognize that they've logged in. And you let the students in one at a time. And anybody else in that lobby who wasn't a student, A, doesn't get admitted into the classroom. And B, now you've separated out any particular miscreants from your student population. So that waiting room is really, really important. It's a really simple thing to do, and it will remove a lot of that potential Zoom bombing that we all heard so much about.
Oh, that's excellent. Terry McGraw is a cybersecurity expert and retired Army colonel. He's also currently the president of PCmatic Federal. Terry, we want to thank you so much for being on the program this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. And I do appreciate you all having this segment because education is the only way we're going to get better. And unfortunately, the criminals are still winning. So your voice is very important here. And I really, really appreciate the opportunity. It's something I'm passionate about.
And we'd love to have you back on, too.
I'd love to come back on anytime.
Okay. Thanks, Terry.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.